starting to wonder if this is holding us back from doing that.
Say goodbye to the rest of the old Haynes School, but not to the idea of a rec center. It's the KHNS Local News. I'm Adam Richard with Tara Bicknell. The news and more up next.
On Tuesday night, the municipality of Haynes closed one door, only to find another one open in the discussion on a future recreation facility for residents. The Borough Assembly voted unanimously at Tuesday's regular assembly meeting to allow the borough manager to enter into an agreement for the demolition of the rest of the old Haynes School. That includes the remaining gym at the price tag of no more than $167,475. It was to the dismay of several members of the public who have fought for the use of the old facility off of Main Street, including Jack Wenner, who spoke during public comments.
The building's been there, you know, a long time. Even your own engineering group that you hired respects the fact that it's a good, solid building, and it'll be there a long, long time. And it could be modified without too much problem, really. So I guess that's all I've got to say. And I'm most disappointed in the fact that the kids won't have any use to use it.
Another user group came forward in recent months with a business plan that would use the building for vocational training and other purposes. Assembly members said it was too late. Scott Rossman and Steve Vick.
The only mistake that I can think of that we have made is we did not, when the equipment and the men were sitting there last fall right now tearing the rest of the building down, not continuing and getting it done for $80,000. Instead, we had to give it a stay of execution for a year and cost us twice as much. That was the mistake.
We've had ideas come and they've gone almost as quick. And this isn't something that should be blinding. Coming from the outside, people are very aware that this has been on our agenda. I really respect people's research and all the ideas they've come up with. But you know, this is in the final stages. This is a little too late to come up with to try to do something, I think.
Several assembly members pointed to the recent report from architects who inspected the facility that said the old school building would require expensive and comprehensive reconstruction to be usable. Assembly members Hoffman and Waterman.
In the MRV report here in the con, it says the gym is too small to function as a regulation basketball court. At only 50 feet wide, the gym is at least 10 feet too narrow to fit either an elementary or high school size support, even without spectator seating. You know, I kind of think that we're, as much as I would like to see a rec center here, I'm starting to wonder if this is holding us back from doing that.
I think it's angry. And implications. It's like first we took down the really, really old original school because it was pretty rotten and we didn't want that gangrene spread. We wanted to try and save that big toe and you got the big toe, but now let's take off the toenail.
But the end of the old gym did not necessarily mean the end of the recreation center idea altogether.
You know, a couple weeks ago, I was given a tour of the Chilcat Center, and there's parts of it I didn't even know existed. In the basement of that, there's two complete shower rooms, his and hers, dressing rooms, lots of square footage that is not being used right now and hasn't been used in years. And we're paying to heat it all the time and we're going to dump a bunch of money into it. And I'm like, well, right there's a space for any one of these things listed here, at least in part. So if you want a teen center, if you want a workout center, if you want a recreation center, right, the Chilcat Center is a damn good start for right now.
But I would like to start a discussion on the assembly level or a committee level or whatever, and I don't know if this is the time to do this, to improve the use of the Chilcat Center.
The assembly made no official move on the Chilcat Center idea, but the Chilcat Center Advisory Board met on the Thursday following the meeting and discussed the topic. Assembly liaison Steve Vick reported that the members were interested in the idea and would bring it up again. Vick is also liaison to the Government Affairs and Services Committee and says they'll include the topic in their next meeting, which he says might even be held in the basement of the Chilcat Center for the Arts. If you want to know more about the space under discussion, go to our website. Photos and a video tour of the Chilcat Center basement are online at khns.org alongside this newscast.
For KHNS, I'm Adam Richard. Stay tuned for the Alaska Fisheries Report.
From KMXT in Kodiak, this is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Jay Barrett. Coming up this week, we're focusing on one story, the events leading up to the downfall of Senator Lisa Murkowski's fisheries aide, Arnie Fugelbach.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is supported in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company,
and by
the Pebble Partnership, pursuing jobs and opportunities for Southwest Alaska. Find out more at pebblepartnership.com.
When Senator Murkowski's fisheries aide pulled out from consideration for an influential job in the Obama administration 2 years ago, he said it was because the process was taking too long. It turns out Arnie Fugelbach was under investigation by the very agency he would have run. Fugelbach pleaded guilty to breaking federal commercial fisheries law before joining Murkowski's staff and resigned from his job with her right before the charges became public. APRN's Libby Casey has more.
As early as 2007, two of Arnie Fugelbach's crew members tried to alert authorities to his illegal fishing. One would not go on the record for fear being blacklisted by the fishing community, but the other is talking on tape for the first time. Dan Price was reluctant, but agreed to meet at a diner near his home in the lower 48. He gives an example of how they'd fish someplace like the central Gulf of Alaska instead of where they were supposed to, west of Kodiak.
It's over a 20-hour run, so to run out there will cost you thousands of dollars in the fuel. There's no numbers of fish there. What you can do in a 10-hour period in central Gulf is going to take you a week west of Kodiak. Plus, it's going to cost you at least an extra $5,000 to $10,000 in expenses.
Price worked on the vessel, the Camelar, for 16 years, starting when Arnie Fugelbach's dad was in charge. He stayed on board when Arnie took over until Price lost his job in 2005. He says the crewman who replaced him had his own quotas to fish, which meant the boat could catch more. He got upset watching Fugelbach rise through the ranks of the fishing management world, sitting on major councils that allowed him to shape policy and gain influence. Yet Price knew that even as Fugelbach was held up as a model fisherman, he'd been breaking the rules for over a decade. Fugelbach went to Washington to work for Senator Murkowski on fisheries issues in the fall of 2006, and the following spring, Dan Price started calling law enforcement. At first, he was scared, using anonymous payphones and trying to find out if he would get in trouble, but he says the feds told him they weren't in the habit of hanging out to dry the people who helped them. On May 11, 2007 alone, Price's phone records show 9 calls to National Marine Fisheries law enforcement in Alaska. He says initially the feds seemed interested. A crew member who shared Price's concerns and knew he was blowing the whistle tipped Price off in June 2007 that the Camelar was docking in Petersburg with illegal fish. Now, Arnie Fugelbach was not on board. He'd gone to Washington, leaving in charge a hired skipper. But Price says evidence on the boat could have exposed information about when Fugelbach was captain.
I called the National Marine Fisheries and told them, here's your opportunity to get the logbooks, get the computer, and find out that I was telling the truth. All they had to do was do a standard boarding. If they did a regular detail boarding, they'd find the illegal fish and they'd give them probable cause to do everything that they needed to do to get the information.
One day later, federal officers with National Marine Fisheries, or NIMFS, boarded the boat and seized rockfish and halibut that weren't reported on the fish ticket. The crew said they were for personal use, not to sell, but it was a lot. The rockfish weighed 1,300 pounds after being headed and gutted. They'd hid the catch, packing the rockfish in 2 totes that were covered in cocoa mats to make them look unused. The feds and state slapped the skipper and boat with about $11,000 in penalties for misdemeanors and violations, including lying to an official. But in the course of the investigation, an Alaska wildlife trooper interviewed a crew member who provided some damning information. The deckhand had been aboard the Camelar for over 20 years and said this has happened every year, once or twice a year. He talks about taking bycatch off the boat at night or offloading to tenders that wouldn't be boarded by authorities. He said he knew it wasn't right, but that if he'd blown the whistle, he would have been out of a job. NIMS officials won't say whether those comments prompted follow-up or if they were looking at a bigger problem than the isolated offense of taking home bycatch. But Dan Price says they contacted him.
It was very shortly after, within a day or a couple of days, they called and they asked me to wear a wire. They asked me if I would wear a hidden mic and contact Arnie And I just told him no. And the reason is because Arnie and I aren't friends, because I was pissed at him for taking my job. So I told him no, it won't do any good, and there's no point to it. Plus, it would tip the hand, I thought.
After that, Price heard nothing. He says when he called NIMS, he was told a variety of things, including that the case was being pursued by the state, but no news on what the feds were doing about his accusations against Fugelvog, which were much bigger than failing to report home pack on a fish ticket. Price's phone records show at least 16 calls to NIMS law enforcement that fall.
The next time I called, they told me that their supervisors, the people in charge of the Juneau Enforcement Office, they said that their boss had told them that the case was over. They had done a complete and thorough investigation. They could find no wrongdoing and that the case was closed.
But Price and three other longtime crew members say back in 2007 and 2008, authorities never questioned them as part of an investigation. Whether the feds dug into Price's claims is unknown. APRN has requested records, but the recent acting director of NOAA's Office of Law Enforcement, Alan Reisenhoover, would not be interviewed and said in writing that it does not comment on whether it is or has been conducting investigations and that it takes all complaints seriously and acts on them as needed.
For more details on the Arnie Fugelvog story, go to APRN.org.
And that's all for this edition of the Alaska Fisheries Report from KMXT and Kodiak. I'm Jay Barrett.